in the late 60s and early 70s. So people, when they do say high energy scattering of say hadrons, they realize that the hadrons, or say more specifically the mesons, they are more like a bound state of two quarks, or one quark and one antiquark, glued together by some flux of gluons. The gluons seems to be very strongly interacting. And when one really tries to separate the two quarks, one can really say never break the flux tube. So that, to a zeroth order approximation, looks like an open string from a quark to an antiquark. So one is naturally led to try to quantize, try to study such a system. And the first thing is to do is just say try to understand the classical dynamics of that system, and then try to quantize it. So we all know how a classical string behaves. So it's just have some mode propagating on it. So for example, the ground state of the string would be just very close to each other, the two parts are very close to each other, and then when one tries to excite the string, it will become longer and longer and try to have some mode, or even longer. So these different vibrational mode along the string can be naturally matched to the resonances in the strong interaction. Specifically, let me try to write down some formulas. If you really try to quantize the string, which I will not do for you today, but may do it on Thursday, you can calculate what is the mass of the string for the different modes. And you can find out that the mass square times double prime is equal to, let me just write sum over n times n plus some constant. So m would be the mass of the corresponding states of the string. And n here really tells us what is the mode number of the excitation, say, here at the mode. So for that excitation, the mode number is 1, for that is 2, and so on and so forth. And n, and the capital N sub n tells us how many excitations are put to that particular mode. So one can really so you can think about these modes as phonons, or some some excitations of do you know what a phonon is, or what a phonon? So phonon is sort of like, so you know what a photon is, right? I mean, photon is just the quantum electromagnetic radiation. So a phonon is basically, so if you think about a solid, and so it is made of, well, so let's see, let's think about a crystal. So you have all these atoms lying on some selected sides of a crystal. And then you can try to, so there will be some, so the atoms can oscillate around each of the lattice site at a very low energy, meaning that you do not try to oscillate at the crystal very much. there will be some long wave, a coherent oscillation of all the atoms in the crystal, meaning that, say, if I have a lattice here, okay, I can use this for example. If I have a lattice of atom here, a phonon is an oscillation of all the atoms in the crystal in a coherent way. Say on that, you can think about we have say, atoms on each side. An atom here may move delta x, and here is delta x prime, delta x 1, 2, delta x 3, and smaller again, and then move in the other direction. So there will be a wavelength of this delta x that is a space dependent. So each such emotion give us a particular phonon when you really try to quantize it. Basically, so what's going on is that you can think about this as a particular particular eigenmode of the oscillation of the crystal. So that is a particular way to try to diagonalize that the interacting Hamiltonian of the whole crystal. Once we focus on this particular oscillatory mode of the crystal, one can try to excite to a state with one phonon or two phonons or three phonons and so on. So the physical meaning of that is the same as when you try to study a simple, say, harmonic oscillator in quantum mechanics. You can consider the ground state where you do not have say, any phonons being excited, but you can also consider the first excited state or the second one, and so on and so forth. That corresponds to just say, excite more and more phonons. It's the same thing. So it is also a very similar to the case where you study, say, black body radiation, where if you just, say, focus on one wavelength of the photon, you can have one photon with that, say, particular wavelength, but you can also have more and more photons. Okay. So what I'm saying here is that n here plays the same role as the wavelength of the photon or the wavelength of the photon in the n, small n there plays the same role as the wavelength of the phonon in the case of the crystal, or the wavelength of the photon, as in the case of the black body radiation. And on the capital N, there is just counting how many phonons are excited or photons are excited. So what I want to tell you from here is just that. By putting more and more excitations on the string with a various a wavelength, you can make a string with more and more mass. Okay? So you get a particle that is more and more massive. Not only you can make the string more massive, you can also make it have bigger angular momentum. So when you really try to say, excite the string, because all these oscillations are transverse. So these are transverse say, oscillations. When you really try to excite one particular say oscillation, what you are doing, you can think about it as say, acting on the ground state of the string by some creation operators that create the corresponding oscillation, just like in the case of the simple harmonic oscillator, where you know that say the n's excited state can be written as something like a dagger to the power of n divided by this acting on the ground state, where a dagger is the creation operator. In this case, you can also study the quantized string by using the creation operator. In this case, n, so the n's, so at the state that the states that one can build will transform under the space rotation for the reason that the oscillations are transfers to the string. So I would just write it out, say if one try to excite one particular, say, excitation with the lowest wavelength, then you can write it like A with the wave number 1. Here there's a minus 1 there just for some conventional reason, but so one state would be just this. The point I'm trying to make is that because the oscillations are transfers, these creation operators carry an index I, which tells us in which direction the string is oscillating. So by adding more and more such excitations, the string will carry a bigger and bigger angular momentum. And one can actually find out what is the relation between the angular momentum of the string and the mass of the string. And that is captured by a simple Ricci behavior that goes like the following. So if you just one draws the angular momentum of the string versus the mass squared of the string, it falls on a straight line. So that line is called the leading Ricci trajectory. In the case of strong interaction, it turns out that the spectrum of the hadrons and the sum of the resonance states actually fit quite well into that trajectory. And also a slope here can be determined by some calculation which is quite straightforward to be the same alpha prime as the alpha prime appearing here, appearing there, plus some constant. So one can try to measure what is the rough value of the alpha prime from experiment, and that turns out to be alpha prime is something 1 GeV to the minus 2, and 1 GeV, so a GeV is 10 to the 9th power of electron volt. That is alpha prime. It's just alpha prime. It's just conventionally to be called alpha prime. It's just one thing, which is the same alpha prime over there. So the meaning of the alpha prime is really the tension of the string, or the inverse tension of the string. It's so one over alpha prime is the mass per unit length of the string. So this all seems to work quite well for strong interaction. Except that when one starts to consider how the strings start to interact with. So what we have seen here is what happens to the free open strings. And one naturally also wants to consider how the strings interact with each other. So there seems to be a very simple rule to try to understand how they interact. If we have, say, two open strings, one is like that, the other, for example, floating around like that. So let's say our open strings are oriented based on the intuition that, say, one end of the string is a quark and the other is the empty quark. So there should be some natural orientation of the string. So say there is an orientation, then one natural way for them to interact is just, say, the two endpoints meet. So let's say if this is Q, that is Q bar, and that is Q, that is Q bar. So let's say an empty quark and a quark meet and cancel their charge, then we will get a new open string from Q to Q bar. One can try to make this, say, intuition very precise, and you can indeed do that, and that gives us a way to specify how the strings interact. The problem is that once you allow such a process, then there is no reason that the other two ends cannot meet anymore. So if you just start from, for example, a single open string, Q, Q bar, then it can actually interact with itself by having the two ends glued together. So you'll get something like that. So when we really try to impose the interaction, then even if we just start from a theory with only open strings, then we have to run into some closed strings in the theory. So whenever we have a string theory, even if we don't start with a theory with closed strings, we necessarily, in the end, we'll have to include them in the spectrum. So then we have to analyze what are the spectrum of the closed strings. If we try to quantize them along the same line as we have done for the open strings, it turns out that not only we will have states that corresponds to the hadrons in strong interaction, we will have some other states, one of which is particularly baffling. So it corresponds to a particle that is massless and carries spin 2. So we have a massless spin 2 particle. Some of you who came to my last lecture probably still remember that a massless spin 2 particle is precisely what the property of a graviton has. By a graviton, I mean a quantum of the gravitational wave, or the gravitational interaction. So it seems that our theory has something more than what the strong interaction has. It has something that is intrinsic gravitational. That, at the time of the early 70s, was actually taken as a problem of the theory, because people were all focused on studying the strong interaction. And that actually led to kind of the death of the theory. People all moved on to studying the QCD, which is a conventional field theory, which turns out to be actually the right theory for strong interaction. On the other hand, there were a few people, say very few people, who kept working on this for probably a dozen of years, just on themselves. And they were the very first people who realized that actually string theory should be taken as something more serious not just as a theory of strong interaction, but a theory of everything, in the sense that in its spectrum, it really contains all the particles that we have seen in nature, or we haven't seen, but we believe they are there. For example, at gravitons that we believe they are there, but we haven't seen them yet. It also contains a lot more. So why don't we study it? So that's, I guess, one turn of events that first, so that's how string theory first arises as a possible theory for strong interaction, and then seems to, and then evolve into a theory of gravitational interaction, evolve into a possible theory for quantum gravity. So one more thing that I should point out, which is another very nice feature of the theory, is that it also has a very stringent prediction for the property of the space-time that it has to live in. If we impose the fact that the theory has to be a Lorentz invariant, then it turns out that in most of versions of the theory, it predicts that the total dimension of space-time has to be 10. So that's something that you would not see in a conventional quantum field theory. In a conventional quantum field theory based on point particles, there is no a priori consistency condition on the total number of the space-time dimension. And the reason that why string theory has such a stringent prediction is actually quite hard to explain if one does not know anything about quantum field theory. So I would just only mention it without going into details. So now I guess we can try to summarize a few things that are really simple about string theory, and that are really a big pluses for the theory. One is, as we have seen, it contains a lot of particles. You can still argue that it seems to contain too many, because, as I said, it contains particles of arbitrarily high spin. In the case of taking string theory as a theory for strong interaction, we know what these higher spin particles should be. They probably should be interpreted as some hadrons or higher excitations of the hadrons, which has the mass on the order of 1 JeV or 10 to the 9th EV. But if we really try to reinterpret the theory as a theory of a quantum gravity, then we want to say all these, so then quarks, or say antiquarks or gluons, which are really the particles that we need in describing the strong interaction, would be just some really low-lying modes of the string, and then the hadrons are some multi-particle bound states of these quarks. So this should not be, so instead of being interpreted as some oscillations of the string, you should think about the hadrons as some bound states of, say, several strings, of several strings in their, say, ground state. So what happens? So what is the right interpretation of the higher excitations of a single string? There seems to be some new particles with higher spin, with more mass, which we don't see, which are not really the hadrons in the strong interaction. They should be something new, but we don't see them. So you may worry that, so since we seem to have to introduce infinitely many higher spin, high mass particles, how can that be the case since we don't see them? So one natural solution would be just we try to make the tension of the string to be very large. And at the present day, it seems a safe scenario is to take the tension of the string to be on the order of maybe 10 to the 16th GeV squared. So that means that we will push all the higher mass particles to very, very high mass, and we don't see them because our accelerator experiments don't have that high energy, so we can't produce those particles by doing experiment. So then there will be no problem in not seeing them. Another thing that worth mentioning is in addition to the fact that it contains natural candidate for the graviton or the quantum of gravity, it is also a it also has a very stringent structure in the following sense. If we think about a point particle field theory, suppose we know how the theory look like without the interaction, we still have a lot of freedom in terms of how do we specify the how we specify the interaction. Say we have a particle like that going in time. That's the trajectory of the particle. Then you can, even after we know how the free theory or how the particle travels in space-time in a free situation, we still have a lot of freedom to specify how they interact. We can have, say, two particles coming in and then go to a single particle with some probability of the interaction. We can also have a process where we have two particles come in, go to two particles, or two particles come in, go to three, and so on. So only knowing the free limit of the theory is not enough for us to specify the whole theory in the case of quantum field theory. But in the case of string theory, it turns out that the free limit of the theory is so stringent that knowing it, we already know the full theory. Say we start from a string, still an open string, that evolved in time. How do they interact? Once we know how the string really propagates freely in space-time, we basically know how the worth sheet of the string. So each time slicing, this is T. Each time slicing give us a string. And when we really move the string in time, we get a worth sheet, which is a two-dimensional surface in whole space-time. So once we know how a free string travels in space-time, we naturally know how they split. Because basically, to specify how the string moves freely, we have to know how a string moves from here to there. And then when we have to understand interaction, again, well, I'm going to have to be a heuristic, but the free limit tells us that how this, so as a result of the freedom of how one, as a result of freedom that, as a result of the freedom that one has in terms of how to slice a word sheet of string, if you think about a process where one string splits into two, you can either slice it that way, then you may think for yourself that when you meet at that point, you may have some problem how to determine what is the rule of the interaction. But you can think about, well, I just need to impose some boundary condition here, which is the same type of boundary condition that you impose along that line. And then you impose the same boundary condition of the left edge of the right string as what happens here, then you can continue evolving the string worksheet. So that tells you that really what really matters to determine the interaction of the string is the local property, how the string really evolves, and that is already specified in the free theory. So that is the reason why the theory is so stringent that once you know how the free theory behaves, you know how one should add interaction. There is only one freedom here, which is the strength of the interaction. So basically, you can think about when you have a single string, you don't know what is the probability for it to split into two open strings, into two separate strings. Once you specify that probability, then you have specified everything. In other words, once you know what is the probability of that, you also know what is the probability of, say, for example, two incoming open strings going through a process like that. So there's only one parameter left that is something that you can specify, and that is called the string coupling. It just tells us how the string interact, how strongly the strings interact with each other. So that is another very nice property of string theory. It's highly stringent. You only need to know something about the free theory. A third thing that is also very nice about string theory, to appreciate it, you have to know a little bit of quantum field theory. If you don't, we can still say some words. So it has to do with certain divergence in quantum field theory. So if you have learned a quantum mechanics, you probably know how to do a second order perturbation theory. So if I have an interacting theory of particles. So let's say the total Hamiltonian is some free Hamiltonian plus some interaction. Then you can pose the question, what is the correction to the mass of the particle due to the interaction? And that you can calculate by some second order perturbation theory. And in quantum field theory, one has to be more careful because once you have two particles, you also have antiparticles, and you have to take into account both the contribution of particles and antiparticles. And the right way to do it, is really to calculate some Feynman diagram, which I can draw here. And if you don't know what it means, it doesn't matter. Very roughly, a way to understand it is just to think about it as a bookkeeping device for the second order perturbation theory that you learned in your quantum mechanics class, where it says that basically the correction of the energy, the correction for the energy of a state is given by signing over, let's say, we call this interaction, then interaction of the original state, let's say n, and some intermediate state, okay, call it m. So you can very roughly think about the diagram as saying, so here we have state n, and here we have a state m, which consists of two particles, which consists of two particles. It is the interaction that couples a single incoming particle with two intermediate, with a intermediate two particle states. The point of this is that now we can try to apply the second order perturbation theory to that. This is not going to be exactly right, because we have ignored the contribution from the antiparticles. But let's just try to be naive, just to see where the problem comes in. Then, if the incoming particle carries a momentum, let's call k n, then the interaction should preserve both momentum and energy. So there is a choice. So if one of the intermediate state carries a momentum, let's say k1, the other would carry kn minus k1. So when we really sum over the intermediate states, we have to integrate over k1, where k1 we can specify just based on a momentum conservation. So we can integrate over k1. And then here would be em minus em. And here would be a two-particle state, let's say, has momentum k1 and km minus k1. If we ignore any, say, internal polarization of the particle, and hence the state of the particles can be specified by their momentum only. So if you really look at that formula, you probably will notice that there is a danger that the whole integral may not converge. In fact, here downstairs, the denominator has to go like k1. If the interaction vertex somehow does not decay away fast enough with respect to the momentum, then the momentum integral generically will diverge. And that makes the perturbation theory diverge and useless. It turns out that in the case of quantum field theory, such divergences appear very generically. It was actually one of the big conceptual problems in the from the 30s up to until the 50s that confused people. People don't know how to analyze or how to understand a quantum field theory. And people battled with the divergences in quantum field theory for a long time just to understand it. And it is something now that is well understood. It is well understood in the cases of QED, which is the quantum electrodynamics that describe the interaction of the photons with, say, electrons, protons, and all the electrically charged particles. It is well understood in that case, It is well understood in the case of strong interaction, which is now described by QCD, which is quantum chroma dynamics, where you have quarks and antiquarks and say gluons interacting with each other. It is also well understood in the case of weak interaction, which controls the say the decay of some nucleons. And by the way, the weak interaction is unified with the electromagnetism into the electroweak theory. So in all the cases that we know that we studied in particle physics, we know how to handle these divergences. It's through a procedure called renormalization. The rough idea is that basically the reason that you see the divergence is because we are, so here really when we really try to write out what is this interacting Hamiltonian, it has to involve some couplings, will involve some coupling constant. So the idea of how to handle these divergence is that the couplings that appear in the Hamiltonian should be interpreted not as the real coupling, or should not be interpreted as the strength of the interaction that we measure experimentally. It should be the result of the whole calculation. So we just first put in a coupling, and then we do a calculation, and then we get a result, which depends on how we cut off that integral. So in the end, we will get a result that is a function of both the cutoff lambda. So by a cutoff, what I mean is that since if we really integrate this d3k over the whole R3, we will get some divergence. So why don't we just not integrate over the whole three-dimensional space, but only integrate over a three-dimensional ball with a finite radius? If we do that, then we'll get a finite result, which depends on how we choose the radius of the ball. Okay, so in the end, we will get a function which is a function of the cutoff and some couplings, which I will call G. So the idea of doing renormalization is that, so let me call this G bear. The idea of doing renormalization is that one, say, try to calculate through the perturbation theory, a process where, say, one scatter two particles, they interact and then have two outcome, starting from two incoming particles and get two outgoing particles. Calculate the whole process using the whole method, get a result which is a function of the cutoff and the bare coupling, and then reinterpret that as the true coupling or the strength of the interaction of this process as you measure from experiment. So from there you get a relation. So that is a number that we measure from experiment, which we know. So from here we get a relation between the bare coupling and the cutoff. Using that relation and then feedback to all the other calculations that you want to do, it turns out that it always works in such a way that in the end of every other calculations that in the end in the every other calculations that you do, lambda and G bear always appear in the same combination that only the G measure would appear in the final result. So that is a way to handle the divergences in the sense that you only need to know in the end of all calculations what the couplings that you actually measure is, and then from there you can just do the calculations without seeing any actual divergences. So that is how the divergences are handled in quantum field theory when applied to particle physics. So those are very specific. Those are very specific quantum field theories. When one try to apply this whole technology to study the quantum field theory for gravity, people really meet big problems. The point of the problem is that in that case, so in the case of studying, say, particle physics, it is always the case that you only need to know a small, well, a finite number, and in fact, a very small finite number of couplings that you have to measure from experiment. From there, you can just go forward and calculate everything and see, you get rid of all the divergences and get some finite answer. In the case of gravity, it turns out that no longer works. In order to really apply this whole technology, one has to know a priori infinite number of couplings that has to play the role of the G mirror here. So that means that since one cannot do infinite number of measurements, it means that if you just build a theory based on that, you do not have any predictive power. You just don't know how to fix those numbers. So that is a big problem for gravity, for quantizing gravity. It's the so-called that gravity is non-renormalizable. So it turns out that string theory really helps on that. And to see it, we can just go back to the picture over there. So in string theory, somehow the UV divergences really disappear. And we can very heuristically see how that happens. The point is, if we just draw the same Feynman diagram for this process, but in the case of string theory, what you will see is a picture that looks like that. Again, you can think about whether we still have the freedom to choose the intermediate, say, momentum K1. If you really think about it, the whole worksheet, say, start to evolve from here. So K1 are the momentum, K over there are the momentum carried by the particles. Here, once we have a string, you can think about there's a whole string, say, moving in space. Each small, say, segment of the string carries a particular value of the momentum. So if you think about here, there is a small, say, segment carries a specific momentum, and you try to evolve it up to here, it still carries, so the amount of momentum of that small segment is determined by how you evolve the free string in time. At the point of the interaction, the string has to be connected in a continuous or smooth way. So once you go from here to here and then here, the amount of momentum carried by that small segment should remain the same. So that's, in other words, once you draw the picture, draw the diagram, you realize that once you fix the diagram, you don't have to sum over anything anymore. Okay. The momentum of the two separate strings, two separate open strings, are already fixed by the very fact that the strings, when they really split, it has to split in a continuous way. Well, I mean, if you think a little bit more, you think, okay, that is true, but when I really draw the diagram, there isn't really a unique way to draw it. So by that, I mean, I can draw the diagram that look like that. I can also draw it look like that. These two things, if I choose the same, so if I choose the same initial and final states in both cases, I can try to change the shape of this while loop diagram. And when I do that, I will automatically change how the momentum is being distributed between the two intermediate states. So when we really try to do a perturbation theory in string theory, you still have to sum over the intermediate states. But now it takes a specific form, which is summing over the shapes of the diagram. In the more fancy words, it's like integrating over the moduli space of some Riemann surface. The point I'm trying to make is that this shift of perspective is actually quite revolutionary in the sense that it really gets rid of all the UV divergences that one see in conventional quantum field theory. But there's no possible way for me to get into the details of this. So I will just only tell you the words that the UV divergences disappear in string theory. For this reason. So we have seen that the theory contains many interesting particles that we have seen or not seen or so on, and we can make the particles that we don't think that we want them to be very massive. And we have also seen that the theory is highly unique. The free limit specifies already the full interacting theory. And thirdly, we have seen that the UV divergences in conventional quantum field theory is no longer a problem in string theory. In particular, in this case, when we have, say, closed strings, and when we have gravitons, there still is no UV divergences. So that really makes quantizing gravity along the approach of string theory free of the kind of problem of UV divergences that one has in the conventional approach of treating gravity as just a quantum field theory, as a local quantum field theory. So that problem of divergence is gone in string theory. There's one other thing which also I just only can mention, but cannot really fully explain, is a highly interesting symmetry that the particle physicist has discovered over the years, which is called the supersymmetry. The supersymmetry is a symmetry that relate bosons and fermions and vice versa. It basically says that, one feature of a theory that has a supersymmetry is that there is an exact degeneracy of states that are bosons that are bosonic and fermionic. So for any state that is, say, bosonic, there should also be another state with precisely the same energy, but it's fermionic. In terms of particles, it means that if you have a particle that is a boson with a given mass, then there has to be a particle precisely with precisely the same mass, but it's a fermion. Not only that the spectrum is specified, not only that the spectrum has this very rigorous relation between fermions and bosons, the way that the fermions and bosons interact are also highly constrained by the symmetry. So that is a symmetry that we don't observe in nature. So it has to be broken in some way. And there are a lot of ways to break the supersymmetry. That is not what we are going to talk about. What I want to say, however, is that supersymmetry is something that you can just impose, or you can is a structure that one can explore just in the framework of local quantum field theory. And it also has, in addition to being a very constrained and elegant structure, it also has a great role in constraining the quantum fluctuations of the quantum field theory. Well, by that I mean if you just still do the same, say, perturbation theory, a quantum field theory with supersymmetry, what you'll find is that generically the UV divergences that we see over here get much milder, and in many cases they just disappear. Okay? So if we have a quantum field theory, you have some UV divergences, and if you furthermore have supersymmetry, then the divergence may disappear. So you may wonder if in a way to quantize pure gravity, there is some divergence and string theory get rid of that. How about we just still quantize gravity as a quantum field theory, but we impose supersymmetry? So we get something called a supergravity. So supergravity is really a supersymmetric version of Einstein gravity. In addition to having some gravitons, you also have to have some fermions that are the superpartners of the graviton. Because we said that supersymmetry relate a boson to a fermion, a graviton is a boson, is a massless bosonic particle, then supersymmetry implies that there has to be some other fermions also precisely a massless. So in a theory of supergravity, you have both the gravitons, you also have their superpartners, which are called the gravitinos. So does the supersymmetry in supergravity theories remove all the UV divergences or not? In most of the supergravity theories that one can construct, it turns out to be no. There is a single supergravity theory that is most supersymmetric. And whether in that theory, which is just a quantum theory of, which potentially could be a quantum theory of gravity without strings, it is called an n equal to 8 supergravity. It is the most supersymmetric supergravity that one can ever build. In that theory, it is still unknown whether the supersymmetry remove all the UV divergences or not. But in all other less supersymmetric supergravity theory, we know that the UV divergences are still there. A supersymmetry cannot remove all of them. So that is a slight distraction to the story of supersymmetry. The point I mentioned it is that it turns out that in string theory, one can accommodate a supersymmetry very naturally. More than that, I don't know what to say without writing down some formulas. So now get to one more thing, which is, so we see that string theory really put very strong constraint also on the space-time dimension. It is a very surprising result. It's the only theory that I personally know of that really predicts what is the space-time dimension. But the problem is that the prediction is not 4, and we live in 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time. So one has to find a way to get around it. So the idea is, again, very simple, and actually dates back a long time ago, probably to the 20s, to two people called Kaluza and Klein. So the idea is that if we have a higher dimensional space, we can try to think, if we have, say, a 10-dimensional space-time with one time and 9 space dimensions, we can think about compactify the whole space-time on a 6-dimensional space that has a very small size. So what the whole space-time look like would just look like there is a 3 plus 1, there is a 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time that we fill, and on top of say every single point of that 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time, there's also a very small, highly curved. Well, there's also a very small, 6-dimensional space. We don't see them because they are really small, so we cannot resolve it. It can be made more precise if you take into account of quantum mechanics. So let's take a very simple example where, say, we start from a 5-dimensional space-time, and then see how we get down to 4. So if we have 5-dimensional space-time, as 1, 4, we consider it is has the same, say, if it has the topology of a 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time cross R, well, cross a circle, let's just think about if we try to do first a quantum mechanics on S1, then we know the momentum of the particle has to be quantized. If the S1 has a radius r, then the momentum of the particle on the S1 has to be n over r. So if the size of the radius is really small, then the momentum is quantized in a very large unit, and we know that e squared is p squared plus m squared. And this p is the total momentum. It can have several components. It can have a components along the 1, 3 in the 4-dimensional directions. There can also be a components along the S1 plus m squared. So if we focus on, if we are a 4-dimensional observer, which say we only measure the 3 plus 1 dimensional components, the 3-dimensional components of the momentum, then that piece will just act like an effective mass of the particle. So what we see, we will see a tower of particles with bigger and bigger mass. And if we just say consider a particle with the rest mass being 0 initially, then so this will be the 4-dimensional mass of the particle. So what we see is that basically the mass in 4 dimensions will just grow linearly as n. So we'll see a tower of particles. When we really make the size very small, then the gap of this sequence of masses would be very large. What that means is that if we really just do some low energy, say, scattering experiment, we will not be able to excite these higher mass particles, which are, by the way, called the Kaluza-Klein particles, we will not be able to excite these KK particles. KK particles. That's a more precise, so that is a more precise way to phrase our intuition that when the size of space is really small, we cannot resolve them in the sense that we cannot really produce some particles that have a non-trivial profile of wave function along the circle. So that is a standard way of how do we remove the extra dimension, how do we hide the extra dimensions from a theory with more space-time dimensions. Let me see, where do I want to go? Question or what?
I have a question. To have that M1.4 and the M1.3, how do you represent those? Or is there another way to represent them?
That's a good question. So I guess you want me to write down the space-time metric for that?
Yeah, that would be amazing. If we're going to have to use it at some point, probably.
You may not need to use it, but I can still write it out for you. Oops. So if you just take that say example, then we can write, so the way to specify the space-time is really just by writing down their metric. Then let's say the metric of five-dimensional space-time would be, let's call it GMN, where N goes from 0 to 4. So that is a 5 by 5 square matrix. You can write it out. So let me call this is mu. So mu and mu runs from 0 to 3, and so this component I will call g mu nu. And here is G nu 4, G 4 nu, and G 4 4. So that's just really I'm just write out the whole metric and call the different components the different names. I've done nothing meaningful yet. So in the case where the whole space-time is of this shape, 1, 4, is a product of a 3 plus 1 dimensional space cross an S1, this is a convenient way to separate a metric. And that part will just is naturally the metric along the 3 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space. And that part of metric is naturally tells us that the size of the circle. Because if you really think about what this whole metric is really dx squared. I mean, it appears in this, right? Dxn, dxn. So the g44 components multiply the square of a dx4, and that is the line element along the circle direction. So g44 tells us about the size of the circle. So that behaves like a scalar field in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And these components remember this GMN is asymmetric, so G mu 4 equal to G 4 mu. And that is, we call it A mu, where mu again goes from 0 to 3. So that looks like a vector field along the 3 plus 1 dimensional spacetime. If we focus on, so these things, all these components can be functions of the whole 4 plus 1 dimensional spacetime. As we said, those components which varies along the circle direction, because the circle has a finite size, they, when we quantize them, they will carry a non-vanishing momentum. They will have a large mass if the circle is small. So if we just consider the low energy physics, we are justified to only think about those metrics that only depends on the position of the 3 plus 1 dimensional spacetime position, but are constants along the circle. If we think about, if we focus on this situation, then all these components will just be functions of the 4-dimensional space-time coordinates. And they become a genuine 4-dimensional fields living in the 4-dimensional space-time instead of the 5-dimensional space-time. So we will get a 4-dimensional metric, we'll get a 4-dimensional vector field, which is precisely, which has the same property as which has the same property of the photons, or the electric magnetic potential, A mu, that you learned in E at M, and we have an extra scalar field, which is the size of the circle. And in fact, it is the reason that Clausewitz Klein first invent such a configuration is precisely for the purpose to try to unify gravity with electromagnetism. So that you have both a G mu nu, which is a 4-dimensional metric, and a 4-dimensional A mu for ENM. So that is a standard way to how to hide the higher dimensions. And in string theory, in addition, so we don't have just one single, say, extra dimension. We have six more. So then we just do the same thing. We just choose a internal manifold that is, say, six dimensional, and make its size small, and then we just hide it. That is the idea, and the rest would be just be highly technical. And I can again throw out some names because we still have time. Okay, so I guess one thing that we learned from this very simple context is that the four-dimensional spectrum of the fields that we get from compactifying a higher dimensional theory is specified by how we choose to compactify it. So here we put it on a circle, then we get a metric field and a photon and a scalar. And if you really just work out the math, which is actually quite simple to do, by that I mean you just take the Einstein-Hilbert action of gravity, which I think I didn't really tell you what it is from GR, but I can tell you now. So the Einstein-Hilbert action is an action for Einstein gravity. As you know, probably from a classical mechanics, you can derive the equation's motion from a Lagrangian, or from an action by a variational principle. It's the same case when we have a classical field theory. When we have a field theory, you can again think about it as just a classical, a mechanical system with infinite number of degrees freedom. That is what it is, because you can think about there is a degrees freedom on each point of space-time. So that's like a classical mechanics, but, well, okay. A better way to think about it is, again, think about a solid or a crystal, where you can think about there is, on each, say, lattice point, there is some classical degrees of freedom. Then in the limit where you take the, say, the lattice spacing to be infinitely small, you will see a continuum of, say, degrees of freedoms filling the whole spacetime. And that is a good model for classical field theory. So you know when the lattice size is finite, it is a classical system. You can describe it by some Lagrangian, by some action, and then by doing some a variation, you get some classical dynamics out of it. Then in the continuum limit, surely you can do it. So in classical field theory, you can start from an action or from a Lagrangian, do some variation, and you'll get an equation motion. So in the context of gravity, there is an action which you can use that reproduced the Einstein equation that we learned last time. And that action is called the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is first written down by Hilbert and then blah, blah. So there was a dispute there. There is some dispute of credit, but it's first written down by Hilbert. So what I'm trying to say is that here, if you start from the five-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action, which I can write down for you, which is really simple looking. Where G5 is the determinant of GMN as a matrix, and R5 is the Ricci scalar built on top of this five-dimensional metric in the same way that you saw last time. If you just start from that action, and then plug in this specific form of metric into the action, do the calculation, what you will find is this whole thing will equal to 2 pi r d4 x g 4 r4 plus, if I call this equal to sigma, e to the 2 sigma f mu nu this whole thing times e to the minus sigma. So I don't know if you have seen the action for the electro, you have seen the action for Maxwell theory or not. So what I'm going to say is here, you get a new action, where the first term is precisely the Einstein-Hilbert action in the lower dimensional space, and that describes the gravitational interaction in the lower dimensional space time. And the second term in the action is the action for the Maxwell theory, meaning that if you doing a variational calculus with it, you will get an equation motion, which is precisely the Maxwell equations. Yeah. So that is
So it's still, you can track the index somewhere.
So from here, the point here is that the compactification procedure allows you to reduce a higher dimensional theory to lower dimensions. You can read off the spectrum of fields in the lower dimensions. You can figure out their interaction. I mean, it's a very cool idea. I mean, it's just that you have a theory that lives in high dimensions, and then you can choose whatever internal manifold that you want to use, then you will get, say, different theories in lower dimensions. In other words, so here is just like, I mean, without going to the details, I think actually I don't need to go there. I can just tell you. So the philosophy in string theory right now would be just that. So we try to build a string theory model that can give rise to the right feature of our, say, particle physics. And how do we do it? So I told you that we have a 10-dimensional theory, and we have to compactify it down to 4 dimensions. So there is a whole industry that has been going on for probably almost 20 years or more. Well, let's say about, say, 20 years, maybe a little bit more, which is just how to choose the manifold that we put the theory on, how to choose the sixth dimensional manifold. If you choose, so the hope is that if you can find the right, say, sixth dimensional manifold, replacing the circle in that, say, simple, say, example of occlusal Klein theory. If you can, so the question is, can you find a sixth dimensional manifold such that when you reduce the whole theory on that manifold down to 4 dimensions, you get precisely the right spectrum of the particle physics that we see in the accelerators. Like you get the quarks and leptons and photons, the gluons and Ws and Zs and Higgs. So that is kind of like a central research, one of the central research directions in string theory. So I guess I can throw out some names. So there's one more qualitative point I can make, which is there is a mystery in particle physics, sort of. So we know from experiment what the particles that we see are. They are now put into a nice, neat model called the standard model of particle physics, with a lot of particles. Most of them are fermions. Some of them are gauge bosons. And we can measure their interaction, their coupling constants very well. We know what their values are. But there is one thing, which is it seems for the fermions, say, for example, the quarks, they appear in precisely 3 families. They appear in 3 generations. So you have a group of fermions which have the same quantum numbers, but they repeat in 3 times. They repeat 3 times. And the same apply to the leptons. So you have a group of quarks and leptons. So quarks, you have, say, quark and antiquark, and each quark have, say, 3 colors. So let me see, how do I say this? In each generation, you have 2 quarks. Okay, 1 quark. So in the first generation, you have up quark and down quark. Each quark has 3 colors. So this 3 has, say, nothing to do with the 3 generations I'm going to talk about. Okay, it is just another a quantum number of the quark which, say, happens to take, say, 3 possible values. So in each generation, you have 2 quarks. In the first generation, these 2 quarks are called up and down. Each of them carry 3 colors. And also in the first generation, you have 2 leptons. One is electron. The other is the electron neutrino. So that is the first generation. And the second generation just repeat the first generation, but with higher mass. So each particle in the first generation has a correspondence in the second one. The only difference being that the particles in the second generation have a higher mass. And this pattern repeats itself three times. You have first generation, second generation, and third generation. No one understands why. Because if the theory has three generations are consistent at a quantum mechanical level, based on all that we know, which are very solid, we know that if we have just one single generation, then the whole theory is also consistent. If we have only two generations, it is also consistent. If we have 10 generations, it is also consistent. Right? So we don't understand why three, why precisely three are generations. String theory, so there's a very nice thing in string theory is that in certain models of compactification, in certain models of compactification, it turns out that the number of generations of particles are precisely determined by the nature of the manifold that we choose. In particular, it is a very stable nature of the manifold. It is some topological invariant of the manifold that determines the number of generations of particles that appear. So that's a nice thing. So by a topological invariant, what I mean is just something that is some number associated to a manifold that is independent of the size of the manifold, independent of how you continuously, say, deform the manifold. One example that I'm sure you know of is the Euler number of, say, a Riemann surface. Say, if you have a sphere, its Euler number is 2. If you have a torus, its Euler number is 0. In general, if you have a genus G Riemann surface, the Euler number is 2 minus 2G. You can calculate it by choosing a triangulation of the surface and then count how many vertex there are in the triangulation, how many edges there are, and how many faces there are. You add up the number. Well, you add the number of vertex minus the number of edges plus the number of faces. You get a number. That is a number that is invariant under all the continuous deformation of the surface. No matter how you massage the surface, that number is invariant. So that is a simple example of a topological invariant. It turns out that in certain model building scenarios in string theory, the number of generation of particles that one get from compactification turns out to be determined by a strict analogy of this particular number to the more complicated manifold that we choose in string theory. So that's a very nice feature, and I think we can call it a day now.